Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine, the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
We were talking last week about the development at the early stages of towns under the Anglo-Saxons, and we were talking in particular about major trading places such as Ipswich, Southampton, and London. And I think it's worth pointing out that this was linked, as indeed had been the earlier development of towns under the Romans, to broader networks. I mean, I think that's an important point, that the history of towns is not just the history of, as it were, Saffron Walden or Norwich, Ipswich or Isleworth. They're also the history of the networks within which those towns are located, networks that are often directly responsible for the growth and prosperity of the towns and to which the towns contribute. So obviously with the Romans, it was the Roman Empire, and we mentioned the significance of towns that were both legionary fortifications, such as York, centres of government, such as York and London, ports, such as London, and so on with the Anglo-Saxons. And there were both centres of government, of which the classic one was Winchester, York as well, of course. But there was also, and for the Church Canterbury, there was also the development of these ports linked to broader socioeconomic patterns. And here, I think it's very significant that it's the scale and importance of English wool exports, the ability to produce something that can be monetarized, that's very significant, because profit can be obtained along the stages of the export. And the trade was to the Low Countries and the Rhineland, which was an area of a silver economy, with the silver coming from the Harz Mountains in Germany. And for those of you who've been there, you will know towns like Goslar, major centres of prosperity resting on the mining of silver in those mountains. And as a result of which, what you've got is more wealth in eastern and southern England, reflecting this export trade, and indeed extensive metal detector finds from the 1990s have revealed that the volume of coinage, insofar as that evidence is useful, which it is, was very high in these regions. And I think one could argue that the southern North Sea was a unifier that contributed to the wealth of eastern England and the development of its towns. There were major mints in which silver was coined in Canterbury, Ipswich, London, and a smaller one in Rochester. And they reflected the monetarization and commercial strength of those regions. Now, the situation was different in Western England. There was less monetarization, for example, in the Northwest Midlands, the area in Cheshire, for example. As a result of that, if you look at power politics plays a role, getting control of areas that have high liquidity is significant, just as it is today. I mean, one of the attractions of Taiwan for China is the high liquidity that Taiwan has. You might argue that, although there are many other reasons, that Putin's ambitions for control over Ukraine in part reflect its mineral and agricultural wealth. That isn't the only explanation for things. I mean, there is no economic value to Gaza, for example. It's a significant factor in modern power politics, and you won't be surprised to hear it was important in the past. So Offa, the major king of Mercia in the 8th century, after whom the wall is named, his ability to gain control over London was very important to the economics and finances of Mercia and provided a tax basis for his policies, whereas being in control of Cheshire just didn't do that. Ambition to dominate his neighbours, Northumbria or Wales, was helped by his ability to pay his troops in silver. And he also was responsible, and the Mercians as a whole were responsible, for fortifying towns, for example, Hereford and Tamworth, in order to secure their position. Now, all of this was threatened by the Viking invasions, which began, of course, the Viking attacks began in the late 8th century, destruction of Lindisfarne, I think it's 793, and the invasions gathered pace from the mid 9th century. There was much devastation. The attackers concentrated on towns and monasteries where there was wealth to seize. So they stormed, for example, Canterbury in 851 and attacked Sandwich that year. They stormed York in 866 and they attacked many other settlements. Church activity was much disrupted. Some bishoprics, such as those of Hexham, Caister and Dunwich, disappeared, while episcopal seats were moved from Leicester to Dorchester-on-Thames and from coastal Lindisfarne via Chester-le-Street to less vulnerable Durham. The situation, however, was different to that of the fall of Rome in the early 5th century, in that urban life and institutions were then more ephemeral, far more ephemeral than had been the case in the 5th century, perhaps for the late 9th century, not being tied into a single overarching system of government allowed them flexibility and adaptability. By the 10th century, moreover, a more extensive urban network was in place. Numerous burghs, B-U-R-H, so that's a singular, so with an S for the plural. So these were earth and timber fortified positions. Numerous ones were founded, not only as military bases against the Vikings, blocking routes, covering river crossings and anchoring frontiers, but also at towns that both secured royal authority and forwarded economic activity that in turn supported military presence and crown finances. It used to be argued that many of these burghs were founded by Alfred of Wessex, who was king from 871 to 899. It's now more generally accepted by specialists that the fortified places were mostly established before Alfred, whereas true urbanization came later and for different causes. It's even possible that Offa was much more important than Alfred in the original construction of burghs. Some settlements, Bath, Chichester, Exeter, Winchester, were refoundations of Roman towns and or post-Roman settlements. So Hereford, which had been the seat of a bishopric by 680, had early 8th century fortifications from the Mercians, but was reconstituted as a burgh in 893, being followed by Shrewsbury. And Hereford, Tamworth and Winchcombe all indicate rampart sections respectively from the Mercian and West Saxon eras of control. Some burghs, such as Bridport, were newly created places, and the same was true of Viking settlements. Some were refurbished Roman fortifications, York as an example, while others were newly fortified, notably in the East Midlands, for example, Nottingham and Derby. And the location and growth of burghs was also related, the same thing as I've already been talking about with the Roman towns, to developments in the transport system. So the burgh at Oxford was linked to the construction of a bridge across the Thames, which facilitated movement to and from the port at Southampton, between there and the Midlands. Similarly, Stamford, a Viking settlement on the River Welland, became more significant than nearby Great Casterton on the more minor River Gwash. Wessex became the dominant political player from the late 9th century, although coin finds in the late 2-teens in Oxfordshire and Herefordshire of coins minted in London and produced jointly in the names of Alfred and his Mercian contemporary, Ceolwulf II, indicate that Mercia continued to have at least an influence. But with the Vikings pushed back, London passed from Mercian to West Saxon rule, and that was important to the anchoring of the West Saxon position. Alfred's successor, Edward the Elder, built a number of boroughs, including Manchester in 919, which was established in order to limit the danger of Viking invasion of the northwest Midlands from the Irish Sea, in other words, from the Viking base at Dublin. And the driving back of the Vikings also focused on the capture of Viking towns, notably the five boroughs, Derby, Leicester, Lincoln, Nottingham and Stamford, which was each the fortified burgh of a Danish army, or Danish force, I suppose I should say, ruled as a Danish jarldom, so sort of primitive earldom. The capture of York, Northampton and Bedford was also significant in the advance of Wessex forces. York was a key place in dispute. It was captured by King Athelstan of Wessex in 927, regained by the Vikings after Athelstan's death in 939, when Wessex had a tempering of its strength, and finally fell to the House of Wessex in 954. It was the token and reality of control of the north, or at least of Yorkshire, which helps explain the significance of the Viking attempt in 1066 to seize and hold it anew. I mean, it's, you know, we tend to think of 1066 in terms of the Battle of Hastings, and that was, of course, important. But the first battle of 1066 was at Fulford, when Harold Hardrada defeated the local forces. And the second battle was at Stamford Bridge, when a rapidly advancing King Harold defeated and killed Harold Hardrada and Harold's own brother, rebellious brother Tostig. And Hastings was only the last of the battles. In the 10th century, Viking fortified positions had become part of the governmental structure of the English state that was created from and by the House of Wessex. This was not a state that required or was constrained by precise ethnic, tribal, or geographical borders. Instead, towns and their governmental purpose and means played a major role, not least in constructing a system of public courts and governance, and that, in a sense, the system of rule defined the kingdom rather than there being a clear-cut geographical border which says this is where it stops. Although I think it's fair to say that the intensive lordship shown by the crown in Wessex and in South Mercia and the related urban network was not matched further north, notably in Northumbria beyond the River Tees. Indeed, the degree to which there were not towns beyond the Tees increased the significance of control over York. I mean, there's no equivalent, you know, Newcastle hasn't been founded yet in this period. Under Athelstan, the role of towns was demonstrated anew by the importance of the coinage, a process secured by reminting, which was a way in which the purity of the coinage was maintained, new rules were registered, new rulers registered, new reigns, I should say, were registered. During the 10th century, minting became very nearly a royal monopoly, and as a sign of their significance, Canterbury, London and Winchester were allocated 8 moneyers each, while most towns only had 1. In addition, the church continued to focus on towns and was a major aspect of their jurisdictional significance, but also complexity. So there were quasi-autonomous areas of exempt jurisdiction under the church, for example, the liberty of St. Peter of York. Now, the House of Wessex and its achievements were challenged in turn by a renewed Viking assault by King Svein of Denmark and then his son, King Canute. And King Canute and his sons, Harold Harefoot and Arthur Canute, ruled from 1016 until 1042. Canute also ruled Denmark and Norway, and therefore a governmental centre on the east coast of England was more suitable than Winchester, the capital of Wessex. As well as that, Canute didn't have the House of Wessex's cultural, religious and historical ties to Winchester and all that it represented. So Canute and his successors made London their military and governmental centre. And this is a classic instance of the importance to London of broader political developments. London benefited from the resulting commercial links, but also suffered from the Danish removal of bullion from the country. Harthacnut, Canute's surviving son, died in 1042 at the wedding feast in Lambeth of a prominent thane, prominent aristocrat. And again, significant that he dies in London. And the dynasty of Wessex then returned in the person of Edward the Confessor, who became king in part by popular acclamation in London. Meanwhile, I think it's fair to say that London had benefited greatly from the commercial growth of England and from the expansion of foreign trade. German, French, Flemish, and Scandinavian merchants are all documented as present in the early 11th century. The wealth earned from wool exports proved the basis for an effective silver currency, which in turn supported silk specialist crafts and assisted the process of government by increasing the general liquidity of the country and therefore its ability to pay taxes. And also the way that the tax revenue was more portable. I mean, it's not particularly useful to have a certain amount of tax delivered as, so shall we say, 63 eggs. This wealth also made possible the huge sums raised for Danegeld in the years on either side of 1000. Danegeld is the money that was paid as ransom to the invading Danes, and these sums explain finds of English coin in Scandinavia. By 1100, London had a population of between 10 and 20,000, so it was by far the largest town in the country. Growth, including in Southwark, south of the Thames, involved both infilling and the development of new streets lined with timber houses. Property boundaries were fixed as an aspect of the growing sophistication of urban governance. Archaeological work in the 1990s at the eastern end of Cheapside in the City of London has shown that the Poultry, which is the name of that street, was built up with a row of buildings from the 10th century, followed by new streets, and then with the surviving open spaces filled in with large stone properties in what became a mercantile area. Now, part of the growing wealth was spent on the church, on parish churches, monasteries, nunneries, and hospitals. Hospitals being often for the care of the elderly as much as the sick, most of which have an urban location. A lot of monasteries in this period are in and close to towns. It's not till you really get to the Cistercian order, which comes later, that there's an emphasis in England on monasteries in the middle of nowhere. And much of the land surrounding it, London, was indeed granted to the church in late Saxon times. Edward the Confessor rebuilt St. Peter's Monastery, or the Westminster, as a larger structure, and also constructed the first royal palace on the site at Thorney Island, where the River Tyburn entered the Thames. The first large Romanesque building in England, Westminster Abbey's new church, was consecrated in 1065, and Edward the Confessor was buried there in 1066. Winchester had in part been replaced as a centre of royal concern and governance, although it was still the site of the treasury and the exchequer into the 1150s, only that being moved to Westminster itself under Henry II. I think it's fair to say that the overall significance of urban activity increased as towns were seen as useful and were developed to be useful. By 1066, as a result of migration from rural areas, migration that was spontaneous and not government directed, these people also were not, being forced to go there. It's a pre-census age till 1801, about 10% of the population of England lived in towns. And this section of the population was more clearly under royal government than rural areas were. Linked to this, both towns and royal power were most present in the south, where again they were more significant for the economy. Now, with the Normans, obviously William the Conqueror, 1066, seized power after his victory near Hastings. And of course, it's significant that the first place he sought then to gain power over was London, where having been repelled at the bridge, he marches round to the west, crosses the river, and approaches London from the northwest, having got himself crowned in Westminster. Subsequent campaigning, much of it is to be concerned with control over towns, including, in fact, a siege of Exeter, where I live. So towns were brought under a new ruling group, which had very few links to its predecessors, and the consequences very much varied by town. The particular role of new local lords was important, as was that of the crown. But what is interesting is that many of the Norman castles were focused on towns and were clearly designed to control them. Although, obviously, the subsequent history of the country, with the extent to which most rebuilding has been in towns, is such that for most Norman castles, I mean, there's a conspicuous exception with the Tower of London, but that for most Norman castles, our evidence is better for castles that were not built in towns, built in the countryside. But anyway, the control of towns and the routes focused on them was very important to Norman castle building. For example, the first castles in Lincolnshire were at Lincoln and Stamford, the latter a key position on the route to the north, the lowest crossing point on the River Welland, but also both already existing towns. There's certainly no national master plan implementing strategic considerations in the location of castles. But William maintained castles in the shire towns, such as Exeter, Nottingham, and Oxford, where, of course, they were the centre of power and governance by his delegate, the sheriff, and they were part of the framework of royal government. London, where the White Tower was to be the centre of the Tower of London, was crucial to this process. Whilst the monarchy settled down at Westminster with buildings there that satisfied its residential, administrative, and religious needs. Many castles, for example, at Cambridge, Chester, and Wallingford, were built over parts of existing towns, devastating their townscapes. And this was an aspect of the destruction brought by the Norman conquest. The first castle at Norwich, for example, was a motte and bailey structure, a wooden stockade atop an earth mound. But consolidation led there and elsewhere to more imposing and permanent structures. So by 1125, Norwich's mound was crowned by a strong square stone keep. And obviously, stone was much harder to burn and therefore harder to destroy. In addition, the Norman presence in northern England was anchored with the building of castles, particularly in Durham in 1072, Newcastle in 1080, and Carlisle in 1092. And the city of Wall of Carlisle was to follow, but it's the castle that was the key element. That was what William II wanted to protect. The town was a lesser consideration, though still important. Newcastle, again, the castle came first. The town wall came later and was probably a matter of earthworks initially rather than a stone castle. Now, the resources devoted to castle building clearly would have had a serious impact on society, much human labour, much money. So also with Norman civil wars, notably that under King Stephen, who ruled from 1135 to 1154, during which control over both Lincoln and in particular London proved especially important in the course of that conflict, as also to the civil war at the close of King John's reign and the beginning of that of Henry III. So major fortified positions were absolutely set, which were fortified towns, were absolutely central to the civil wars of the period. And indeed, at the beginning of Henry III's reign, Henry III came to the throne in 1216, there is a very significant battle around the fortress at Lincoln and also, of course, around Dover. Now, it's not only power in the state that is significant, but also power in the church. Stone-built cathedrals and churches took many resources over many years and expressed power. as when the great Northumbrian holy man, St. Cuthbert, was disinterred, removed, and reburied in the bold new cathedral at Durham in 1104. Dioceses and abbeys were taken over by Norman appointees, the first, for example, in St. Peter's Abbey, Gloucester, being Serlo in 1072. And the reorganisation of the diocesan system by the Normans included the transfer of sees to more major urban centres, also places that were, in many senses, centres of secular government, for example, from Crediton to Exeter, from North Elmham to Norwich, from Dorchester-on-Thames to Lincoln, from Sherborne to Salisbury, as well as the foundation of new bishoprics at Ely and Carlisle. There were also new monastic foundations, but the key Anglo-Saxon urban ones, including Bury St. Edmunds, St. Albans and Westminster, continued and furthered their economic and spiritual value to their towns by encouraging pilgrimages. It's worth noting that Bury St. Edmunds and St. Albans are both towns named after saints. That, of course, didn't change with the Reformation. And the cult of relics was also crucial in Canterbury. And indeed, you will recall that the travellers that go to Canterbury in Chaucer's Canterbury Tales are going there on pilgrimage. If you take, for example, Coventry Priory, the presence of the priory greatly encouraged the growth of the town, a process also seen in, for example, Gloucester. Coventry Priory had rights in at least 75% of the properties at Coventry. But church control of this fashion could be unwelcome, as in Abingdon, where a riot in 1327 against the abbey's control of the market led to the destruction of many records, and there was also serious trouble at Bury St. Edmunds. Why would the abbey's control of the market lead to trouble? Of course, because they charged people, and often it was seen as a way in which they charged too much to operate stalls. The church's role in medieval towns contributed greatly to their character as a sort of multiple centre of authority. For the church's role sat alongside royal government, local aristocratic influence, and the activism of the citizens themselves. It's also worth bearing in mind that the church wasn't a united interest, so particular institutions, let us say in a county town which had a bishop, so there'd be the bishop, there'd be maybe individual monasteries that owed allegiance to their order, let's say the Benedictines, there would subsequently be, not at this stage, friaries, and there might well also be individual parish churches who very much answered to their patrons. So the church itself was a divided sphere. And as far as the citizens themselves were concerned, there was also division. There was activism both of the community and of particular groups within it. So the occupationally linked guilds, you know, people like the saddlers, for example, were important to these particular guilds and were generally linked also to specific churches and indeed localities within the town. It's also worth saying that the Norman conquest, was followed by settlement of foreigners, people from the continent, with distinctive areas within towns formed accordingly, for example, in Hereford, Norwich and Nottingham, and doubtless elsewhere. Now, this multiple character, I mean, the jargon phrase is polyfocal, which sounds like a polytunnel to me, but this multiple character had consequences in the physicality of the townscape, in competing jurisdictions, jealously guarding their privileges and independence, and one could say their freedom and freedoms, and in the economic and social character of neighbourhoods, as well as in their politics, their culture, their ideology, their collectivist institutions, and their philanthropic activism. Charity was an absolutely central link between religious institutions and society. Solidarity as a result of all of these was divided and fractured, as well as operating for not just specific goals, but also shared goals. relations between towns and their owners, both their clerical owners and their secular owners. So Coventry comes under the becomes an appanage of the royal family, for example, because it becomes the Earl of Chester, has it, as its lord, and the Earldom of Chester comes under royal control from, I think, the mid 13th century. So Edward I, as Prince of Wales, is also Earl of Chester. So he's the Lord of Coventry. Now, relations between towns and their patron owners could be poor, but there's also the possibility of a closer relationship, not least if the owners took note of the interests and still more self-assertion of their towns. And this polyfocal character of towns was dynamic because it was constantly changing, notably due to political contention, judicial decisions, royal favour, land purchase and building. And if one, group did better or one interest did better, you could bet your bottom dollar that the others would often cooperate against it. The development of London's government brought to the fore many processes also seen elsewhere, and notably the growth of a sense of urban identity. In a society that was reverential to the past and reverential of it, so sorry, I should have said referential to the past and reverential of it, this process was based heavily upon precedent and the perceptions of history. So Edward the Confessor had issued a writ confirming the laws and jurisdiction of a London guild, probably founded in the late 10th century under Edgar. And this writ was placed on the altar of the Priory of Holy Trinity Aldgate in 1125 as confirmation of the guild's gift of land and rights. This sense that an old established right, generally expressed in terms of a gift, was one which would be reciprocated, but also create an allegiance and a loyalty, as well as a set of rights. A link can be drawn from thence to the 1191 Commune in London, which advanced claims for London's interests and brought together Londoners of both English and Norse ancestry. And a key and lasting element of London's identity, and one that other towns sought to match, was that it took precedence over differences in ancestry and lineage, and instead brought together distinct groups into a commonality of shared identity and interest. So by 1191, it appears to be the case in London that the distinction between Anglo-Saxons and post-1066 settlers was more or less obsolete. I mean, one doesn't want to romanticize this too much because, for example, anti-Semitism and the atrocities against Jews in places such as Lincoln and Norwich shows that not everybody was encompassed into this commonality of shared identity and interest. But anyway, pride in London's history, a strong sense of its distinctive identity and importance played a role in its assertiveness and was also expressed in the laws and customs today known as the London Collection that was assembled during the period of opposition to King John in the early 13th century. So urban identity is carried particularly far in London, which is understandable. It's the most populous, it's the wealthiest of the towns, it's the one that has the most developed set of urban rights and privileges. It has the most direct link to the royal government. It's the most prominent politically, as is shown in its role in the Magna Carta crisis and in Magna Carta itself in 1215. And because it's the largest urban space, it's also the one that needs differentiating and organising it. And in a parallel process in London and elsewhere, various mercantile and craft guilds emerged, defined their roles, and asserted their economic and political interests, controlling local production and trade in a process involving regulation, lobbying, litigation, and a certain amount of violence. In London, these guilds, which were linked to the dense and varied texture of ecclesiastical foundations and activity, were to become the city livery companies, which continue to this present day. They were important to the creation in the Middle Ages of the distinctive features of government that provided the context for London's later development, and with parallels elsewhere, although not to the same degree of scale or differentiation. And what, as it were, all of these various associations meant was a pattern of association, which included a depth of governance that shared and thus grounded authority and responsibility. In other words, in the jargon, you have intermediate institutions. Those of you who know your European history may well have read Mark Rafe's RAEFF, Well-Ordered Police State, in which he argued that the greater, as it were, stability of the governance of German principalities in the 18th century compared to Russia is that in the German principalities there were many intermediate institutions, whereas in Russia it was fundamentally a case of the authority of the Tsar and, as it were, very little in terms of anybody else having any particular freedoms or liberties or administrative competence, and that this clearly created a problem. I mean, you might argue that a state is strong if it can execute anybody who's a nuisance, but you could also argue that a state is weak if you can't find people to cooperate with you in taking part in the governance of that polity. So I think it's fair to say, that there was a degree of accountability in urban government, although kings could and did when intervene when they saw fit and impose direct rule and have some exemplary executions. I remember there's a case in Exeter in which a cleric was murdered by another cleric, and the king didn't much like this, and had the person hung and generally threw his weight around. There were particular issues in London when kings threw their weight around. Edward I, for example, threw his weight around. So I think one could present a benign picture of governance, but one's got to be aware that it wasn't always the case. And although the kings generally imposed their power only for short periods, the possibility probably made for a degree of volatility in urban government, as some factions would have welcomed this and others did not. I think we might pause there, Graham. Is there anything you'd like to ask about where we've been so far, as it were?
Well, it's been a very interesting episode. Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you very much indeed. What comes over to me very strongly is that we often think about the early development of towns in terms of commercial imperatives that made them significant. But today, you've largely talked about the role of government in one form or another, be it ecclesiastical or state. Giving them shape and responsibilities and importance. I've got a couple of questions, but first I want to ask a question about the development of new Anglo-Saxon boroughs, whether they were by Alfred the Great or, as you suggest, perhaps by Offa of Mercia. You mentioned Manchester, actually, which was created by Edward the Elder, Alfred's son. But for the most part, these new boroughs, is there any evidence that they were built on top of existing settlements, or were they the Milton Keynes or Stevenages of their day, essentially entirely new towns built on greenfield sites with scarcely anything there beforehand?
Well, I think in practical terms, it's highly dubious there would have been nothing there beforehand. Because in general, particularly if you're thinking of a near a crossing point across a river or marshland, there would already be, one would assume, a settlement there. But there's a big difference between a settlement and a town, not only of scale, but also of jurisdictional of value.
And with the granting of charters, is that something, town charters, is that something which is essentially a Norman and early medieval development, or is there evidence that the Anglo-Saxon kings issued charters which gave their towns certain rights, obligations, and structures of various levels of authority?
Well, there it's largely clearly a Norman and subsequent, but obviously the Anglo-Saxons also had charters. I think it's fair to say that in the Anglo-Saxon period, you would associate these more commonly with ecclesiastical institutions. And the process of defining town rights is relatively limited early on, because most early towns are under lords, either under the crown or under secular lords or under ecclesiastical lords, and therefore, whether episcopal or monastic, and therefore don't require a charter, if you see what I mean.
Well, there's so much more we could discuss, but I'm afraid we're out of time. Professor Jeremy Black, for taking us through the development of towns in the late Anglo-Saxon, Norman, and very early medieval period, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.